The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. So, welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast. Today, we have another special episode, which is a continuation of last week's special episode, where we have more than two people in the virtual room. And one of those people is one of the guests from last week. I'm absolute pleasure of re-inviting Tina Michael. You know, I think based on some of the reception of the last week's podcast, we might make this a continued effort. So she's joining me. I think last week, obviously, I would have introduced her background. She's a professor at Arizona State University, formerly at University of Wollongong, although she might clarify that and she might do a bit of work here and there even now. Amongst a range of other very incredible ventures, presentations that she does. We also have, as our other guest, on the more technical analysis and the less socio-ethical analysis of this conundrum that we're faced with. And his name is Edward Farrell. Now, Edward and I go back for a number of years. We're good friends. And he is not only a friend, but also a security expert. And he's the founder and director of Mercury Information Security Services, MSW. And much to the amusement of all of us on the call, he is a former student of possibly Dr. Katina, although he's not Professor Katina, although he's not too sure, but certainly Professor Katina's husband, Dr. Michael. Anyway, it's an interesting collection of people here. But first of all, Katina, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me back, Nick. I really enjoyed episode one. And I can't believe you've sprung on me the mere fact, the great fact, that I'm honored to have another former student online today in Ed. I want to hear what he's been up to, Nick. I want to hear what he's been up to.
Just hacking the planet. I'm pretty sure.
Do what we teach our students at Wollongong.
Well, they're on the world stage now. That's something. It must be with the name. You know, you don't get too many names. I think bookkeeper. Someone hit me, an Italian person hit me with the question: which word contains three consecutive double consonants? Bookkeeper, and then I thought Wollongong, but I thought Wollongong first. So there's something in it. There's something in the water. So look, you and I, you know, people would know from the last episode about your background, but just give us a 30-second spiel. Did I nail it? Or are you also working with University of New South of Wollongong intermittently, or are you solely at Arizona State?
So a couple of years ago, I got this wonderful opportunity to lead a group called the Society Policy Engineering Collective, where we look at societal issues and how they're impacted by technology. Very broadly. So I'm in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society and also jointly hired by the School of Computing, Informatics and Decision Systems Engineering. And when they let me leave the hot desert in Arizona, because I have a nine-month appointment annually, I get back to Wollongong University for 3 months and do some teaching or mentoring for research students, have my ongoing PhD students still here in Australia, but I'm in the School for Computing and Informatics here in Australia, where I started out back in 2002. And before that, I was on campus working for Nortel Networks for a good 6 years.
All right. So that's clarified. So it's actually, you know, between both. Now, Ed, give us a bit of a spiel. So who are you beyond, you know, being a good friend of us at the show and a security expert? Give us a bit of about your background and how you got to be where you are.
So my background, I've now been running Mercury for just over 5 years. Prior to that, I was doing security consulting and pen testing for BAE Systems. It started off as Stratsec. It then got acquired by BAE Systems. I then was made redundant in March of 2014, moved to Hack Labs, did a few months there, and then went out on my own shortly thereafter. Before that, I was working as a network engineer in Sydney, And before that, I was, funnily enough, at the University of Wollongong for a few years. So then tacking the last 3 years, I've been an industry fellow at UNSW Canberra, or better known as the Australian Defence Force Academy, teaching in their master's program there. So I've done a few courses. I was delivering the computer network operations course for a bit, and I've now just made my focus the wireless and IoT course.
Are you writing and delivering the courses as well, or adapting, or?
Yeah, so the course has an existing academic foundation,
yep.
Which one of the academics has introduced, and I've taken a whole heap of industry scenarios and industry events and even just other things I play with and started injecting that material into that course. So the course itself bounces from the academic space to the conceptual to the technical. We cover off on that full spectrum the whole way through, and that's for a lot of students that becomes quite eye-opening.
Okay. And for the listeners, because more than half are based in Europe, what's ADFA and what's its connection with UNSW, and what's UNSW?
Yep. So UNSW is the University of New South Wales, based in Sydney. The ADFA is the Australian Defence Force Academy, based in Canberra. So ADFA is effectively our military academy. So its equivalents would be along the lines of, say, West Point in the United States. The intent is students come out with an undergraduate degree from that institution and then get commissioned as officers. Now, UNSW Canberra, because of the Cybersecurity Association in Canberra and the close links with Defence and a number of the other organisations down there, there's a heavy focus on cyberspace and cybersecurity. So they instituted a master's degree several years ago to meet that demand, and that's provided to both civilians and military out of the academy there.
Okay. Okay. So if it's provided to both. Right?
What's interesting, Nick and Ed, is Arizona State University has an affiliation with UNSW, both in Sydney at the Kensington campus and ADFA, and also King's College. It's called the Plus Alliance. And one of the groups I'm actually part of at ASU is the Global Security Initiative, which has a lot of the professors from UNSW ADFA on that collaboration.
Oh, okay. And the collaboration's purpose?
Computer security mainly, AI and security.
But collaborating on academic initiatives, joint IP research, or all of the above.
Okay. Yeah, amazing cross-border, I would say, collaborations going on there. And that's when you find people like Ed, you discover them, and they would feed into the localized teaching unit and research unit as a fellow. But I think as time goes on, I'm hoping more broader. You know, we learn about your skill sets, Ed, and they are able to be incorporated in a more global scale.
Okay, well, that brings us up to speed with guests. And just as a side note to the Italian listeners, because the podcast is hosted in Italy, and to both of you, there's a consortium of universities which numbers in about 4,000 universities throughout Italy. It's called CINNI. It's a platform for academic sharing and research sharing and collaboration amongst 4,000 universities and their cyber departments throughout all of Italy. And it's one of the many steps that the nation has taken to enhance and foster a cybersecurity ecosystem, which includes everything from protecting to developing a market and attracting investment money. And I was wondering whether there was anything equivalent, because I mean, you've got AusCyber, which is, for the Australian audience who might be familiar, that's the government-led initiative to build an ecosystem of what homegrown cybersecurity companies. But is there that academic collection of universities? Something akin to, say, Data 61, but it's not exactly that. Do you know?
So there is a defence-oriented sort of call-out that comes to all the universities who want to partner with particular defense initiatives, and some of them are related to artificial intelligence, others to security, others to a combination thereof. But yeah, you need to work through your university's research office, and there is like a central coordinating body that does that beyond the Australian Research Council grants. These are all defense-oriented mainly, but for the greater part, I don't know if there's a direct equivalent with the one that you're mentioning that you're part of in Italy and Europe.
I don't think there is, and I think it's got the potential, a huge amount of potential. Anyway, discussion for another time. So let's jump into the topic. Contact tracing. Last week's episode, I can't remember what I named it, but it was something like contact tracing. You may have seen about it, heard about it in the media. You know, I asked that in jest because we see it plastered all over the news, and the boiled down binary debate is digital trust and versus protecting people and their health. So if we just look at that through that binary lens, it's a bit of a crap offering for people, because then they're given a binary outcome. What I'm very interested to hand it over to Ed and get his understanding, at least from a technical level, and his analysis from a technical level after picking apart the app that Australia has designed. So Ed, let's turn it over to you. You've written four very well-written, very great analyses on which you posted on LinkedIn, which I can direct people on the podcast to have a look at. And they bear relevance for people around the world. Australia was one of those countries which took the initial inspiration from source code by the Singaporean that was designed previously and then built their own additions on top of that. Other countries are doing different bits and pieces. But Ed, give us a sense of at least the technical analysis, the breakdown, the steps that you took to get to, I think, part four in your mini series about the app.
Yep. So the breakdown started about Sunday, 2 p.m. It would have been about the 26th. I did my first teardown from that afternoon through till about 4 a.m. the next morning. Yep. Off the back of which it became obvious the enrollment process seemed fairly sound. The device was providing a Bluetooth parameter that would identify a device, but of course it was clearly encoded, if not encrypted. So then building into it, that parameter was constantly changing every hour. It also turned out the API requests seemed fairly straightforward, nothing more than what you'd require, but it was also requesting to the AWS instance that was providing the ID that was provided through Bluetooth, provided over Bluetooth and beaconing out. That ID would have to be renewed hourly through the app. It then just turned into analyzing what was occurring over the network between the individual device out to the AWS environment, which all seemed fairly straightforward, and then seeing how the interaction would take place off a test device I had, seeing how much data is actually getting recorded, what would be some of the behavior we could determine. And then also based purely on, how I would design the environment, understanding what the backend architecture would look like. And then on top of that, there's a whole heap of other Australians right now that are diving into the individual application itself, just to get their heads around, how it's been put together. And look, bottom line up front, it all seems fairly sensible. My big deduction was it's encrypting the contents on the back end so that as it broadcasts out, if you do make contact and that list of contacts you've made needs to get uploaded, it can then get decrypted. That encryption all looks like it's handled in the AWS environment. It all looks fairly sensible. But I think until such time we actually work out what's happening on that back end, we can't really make any calls. And so, the big thing is we've been able to qualify that. Yeah, look, it looks fairly sensible. It looks fairly sound. But I sense there could have been a lot more that could have been provided to guide us.
Okay. I guess it's important to make sure that we're distinguishing between the security of the app and the broader privacy implications. And I think a lot of people in the public would be conflating them and confusing them. Katina, do you think that's the case? And may perhaps you are able to untangle those two definitions.
So on the privacy side, people are looking to consider personally identifiable information or information they consider sensitive, information that could be used perhaps to reverse engineer or re-identify or relocate someone. And there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with this term tracing. And I've seen words like, but the tracing app doesn't track, and it doesn't. There's no location feature on it in terms of an absolute location on the Earth's surface using a projection or coordinate system. So you're not going to see an X and Y coordinate or a longitude and latitude coordinate. And then I asked the question, but we have this notion of proximity. It's a relative distance between two devices. And at that point, you have to say from the originating point, we're counting about 1.5 to 2 meters as being in proximity, and anything beyond that, perhaps up to the Bluetooth range available, is in sort of what I would call a buffer zone. And so it's not impossible, a lot of GIS people will tell you that, to take points that are recurring and time-stamped over a period of time, because we're creatures of habit, and to deobfuscate, dehide, unravel, unhide these relative location points and make them absolute. And if you have enough of them, what you have is almost like a street structure of households, plotting points. So that's on the one hand, personal privacy. On the other is the sort of CIA model, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And the issue is whether any of these three areas of the pyramid will be penetrated in some way or obstructed or will break down or will fall over. For example, are we going to have someone injecting false information and creating records that are bogus records and perhaps filling up one's memory, even though, our smartphones these days carry a lot of extra power and a lot of extra memory. It would take an exorbitant amount of attack to actually just kill the ability for the device to actually save a record. But there could be injections. There may well be issues to do with breaking the confidentiality and making that at the point, the most critical point perhaps, between the AWS server and perhaps the device, the ability to even delete your records. And so, the claim is made by the Australian government is, hey, you want to delete your records, you want to uninstall the app, go ahead, you can do it. But the truth is you can uninstall the data on your device. You do not have control over all the proximate data that has ended up on another anonymous device in your proximity. And so there's this power control wrestle. So I'll leave it there in the differentiation between privacy and privacy perhaps enhancing technologies. And I agree with Ed, all the privacy scholars that I know that are credible have said, look, it looks like what's been attempted is to keep privacy sensitive. Yeah. And on the side of the security, I'm hearing a few different stories. Look, why did they choose a centralized architecture to implement this and not decentralized?
Mm.
And I don't know, Ed, what you think about that notion of centralized versus decentralized, if you wanted to talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a bit of a look at the model that was put forward by Apple and Google, which probably is a little bit more decentralized, and it also is a little bit more privacy enhancing because you have the 15-minute cycle. But one of my concerns, and you kind of touched a bit on it when you talked about confidentiality and integrity there, is the absence of centralizing it, this technology. Does that now mean you can inject false positives? So one of the things that became quite evident in the way Apple and Google, and certainly in the version I was reading early last week of how they'd implemented their contact tracing protocol using their own stacks, was it was starting to become obvious, where's the process with which a positive contact is in fact qualified as being positive. And then off the back of that, can you inadvertently start injecting an alert where all of a sudden everyone is now infected? Now, the system that the Australian government's put in, you need to actually go through the process, go to a medical professional and say, hey, look, I'm now actually COVID-19 positive. That then gets verified by a medical practitioner, and then you can volunteer the data with which you've collected. Now, off the back of that, they have to provide you with a PIN code before you can actually upload that data set. And then you also have what is effectively manoeuvre warfare, where if you're relying on Apple and Google's system, which will just send a notification to the device, do you actually panic a person? Do you, or does that person disregard their contact because they're now getting several thousand contacts because someone's trolling the system? You know, if you have a phone call from a qualified professional in Australia, in New South Wales Health or in one of the Australian healthcare providers, will that then accelerate and create early access, early response, and help, you know, squash this even further? So it's how can we actually, you know, the less centralized model, sorry, the more centralized model that the government's taken, I think is a little bit more valuable in the sense that there's a need for qualification of a confirmed case, but also the onus is then for Australian healthcare professionals to get in contact and start accelerating the process of responding, which I think the voluntary system that's put out there by Google and Apple is less so. Interesting. I just want to go on a bit of a tangent there with reference to the privacy piece. One of the points I did draw upon, if you look at the Australian system, you can actually register as any name you want or a pseudonym. So right now I'm registered as Carol Baskin on mine. But on top of that, you can in fact register using someone else's mobile number, which if you know you are really absolutely concerned about privacy, you know, I would actually completely obfuscate the data, one, with an incorrect name, and two, with a relative's phone number, and you know, do that with 20 of your best friends, register on the one phone number, have a book of who's which pseudonym, and you know, that also then deals with the other threat vector of should someone be able to get access to this data, it's not really going to be of any great use, but it will still facilitate that contact piece.
I think the transferability piece is interesting. Our phones are not like implants. They're not beneath the skin, as we covered back in class, Ed, many years ago. But they're transferable. They're not bracelets, so you're not wearing them off. And they're not lockable, as some of the early Wearify wireless technologies were, where you know, you placed a watch on your child and you locked it. It was the $99 back to school deal, so you know where your student is all times of the day and week. But this is a mobile handset, and does something like that diminish? Certainly does give you the ability to maintain a certain level of privacy, but it's not really explicit that you can go and put your name like John Doe or something like that. It's a bit like when you fill out your visa application on ESTA and it says, what's your social media handles? And it doesn't say, are you really optional in black bold? It says it in sort of grayed out language. Well, I'm sure most people filling out that installation form, because I know I downloaded and I tried to put my details in until I realized, hey, +61, I don't have a phone with +61. I have a phone with +1, an American phone roaming in Australia. So it wasn't really explicit to me that I could put any name and any phone number, but I like the fact that that's a possibility.
So Bruce Schneier, who's obviously a very well-renowned cryptographer, I imagine most people in the audience of the podcast would be very familiar with some of his work. I'll quote him, and this was slightly contentious and I disagree with a portion of the premise, but overall, I think I actually agree. Quote, my problem with contact tracing apps, they have absolutely no value. Bruce Schneier, I'm not even talking about the privacy concerns, in the efficacy. Does anybody think this will do something useful? This is just government, just something governments want to do for the hell of it. To me, it's just techies doing techie things because they don't know what else to do. And then he goes on to describe false positives, false negatives. He describes cases wherein one might take the app grocery shopping. and subsequently alerts you of a contact. What should you do? It's not accurate enough for you to quarantine yourself for 2 weeks. And without ubiquitous, cheap, fast and accurate testing, you can't confirm the app's diagnosis. So the alert is useless. And this kind of plays into the part that Ed was mentioning, where Australia is only giving you a code and then uploading you as positive after seeking verification from a medical professional. But the initial premise of Bruce's response to every government following a similar kind of viral wave of content tracing development, is this just a knee-jerk reaction? And I guess it'd be interesting to hear both of your comments on that.
I might jump in. I think, you know, Bruce certainly raises a very valid point of the utility. And, you know, I think it comes back to, we probably don't know, you know, if this will actually provide us with anything meaningful just yet. But, you know, I think the same representation could be made about cholera outbreaks in London in the 19th century, where identifying cases and spatially mapping them eventually pointed to specific sources of water in London. And off the back of that, they were able to at least deduct that these water sources are likely contaminated with cholera. You know, we need to stop people from getting water from them. I can probably see a little bit where Bruce is coming from, in the sense that I think such a level of certainty and authority is placed on technology. I think it's actually a greater weakness we have across the technology industry, is we absolutely fail at expectation management. And that's because if we manage expectations, we create doubt. If we create doubt, no one uses it. If there's doubt, well, it doesn't get used. And so this will probably end up being one of the things that plays out, is it works, but it doesn't work in the way we expect it to.
Yeah, because perhaps the perception is it's a panacea.
Yeah, and look, I can actually already start seeing some limitations. You know, the 24 hours I was capturing the device, my interactions with my test device and the Bluetooth and my iPhone, the iPhone wasn't picked up for about 3 hours when I was right there next to it. And then similarly, I've been able to pick up my neighbors.
Can you troubleshoot technically why?
Honestly, it's just Bluetooth. There's a couple of arguments that Bluetooth itself isn't. So the Bluetooth on the iPhone is just switching off altogether after a period of time. But it's also, like, I did a, so I've just come back from the city where a client decided to take advantage that, you know, 90% of his staff were out of the office. So they just wanted to do a quick sweep with Wi-Fi. We identified about 55 different Bluetooth devices, most of which would be owned by staff. I think we were only able to really interact and interrogate about 10% of them. And that's just a limitation of the technology, and also a bit of a hardware limitation and also a range limitation. So, you know, I've had the exact same experience for the last 2 to 3 years in my Wi-Fi class, which is, sorry, my class at ADFA. It doesn't, you know, Bluetooth doesn't work the first one or two attempts, but it eventually gets there. That's kind of a reality of where it's at. I'm sure, you know, your listeners have probably had the same thing where you need to turn it on and off again before Bluetooth works. Probably isn't going to be as effective in contact tracing, especially if you're only, you know, next to an infected person for a minute.
Patino?
Yeah, so Bruce and I is actually an acquaintance of my husband and myself, and we highly respect him. He's very respected in both the privacy and security communities. I think something that he's alluding to is the fact that this is really an after-the-fact technology, right? It's not preventive. So it's a confirmed case. It's trying to mimic the contact tracing manual health surveillance process that the health department usually takes care of. And if we go back to the World Health Organization, they define contact tracing as ID, listing, and follow-up. And all it's supposed to do is, instead of you using your brain and your memory to go, now, tell me who you've come into contact with in the last 14 days. This is supposed to go, well, here is the list. You know, I don't have to really make myself remember. Of course, many organizations today, what are they doing, Ed? They're asking you to go in. And if you go into your office, you've actually got to fill out a Google Doc. That Google Doc shows when you've gone in, when you've come out, why you were there, who you came into contact with. And pretty much that's a reminder that's sent around Arizona State University at the moment every so often at the school level. So if you have to go in for any reason, basically write it down. And so given this is after the fact, and given the fact that many people are also not symptomatic, they're not coughing, they don't have high temperatures, and lo and behold, they've got COVID, like Australia's very well-known media personality who did 4 tests and was positive with COVID for each one, Richard Wilkins, it begs to ask the question if there are all these, like, you know, unidentified zombies going around that are not confirmed cases because they're not feeling sick, and all of a sudden you've got an app that tells you that you've come into contact with someone that's sick, but only if they're aware of the fact that they're sick, you know, only if they're showing symptoms. The other thing that is important to note is Bluetooth is horrid with respect to obstructions, and they could be concrete. They could be things like marble. And the body, would you believe, water in the body is one of the worst things that makes this alleged non-line of sight technology, you know, requiring line of sight. And all of a sudden we've got questions, and you might try this, Ed, with your test at home, your test device, is just keep turning the devices so that the sensors are almost facing each other, if I can say that, if you know what orientation they're in. And turn the phones upside down, you know, at different angles, and see what that does. But when we know this about BLE, we know this about Bluetooth, why in the world have we chosen this? Because we don't want to use GPS as some parts of the world have, so that there is no issue. I mean, look what happened in Israel with courts overturning the use of the GPS and then saying, no, there's going to be a moratorium on this. We'll get back to you, but for now, turn it off. So we've gone to contact tracing. But one thing that should be clarified here, someone's virtual social network is very different to their physical social network. And when I've got researchers in the geospatial space telling me, Kat, all you need is someone's home location and work location, 2 points, and I can pretty much identify 50% of the population. And if I have 4 or 5 points, I can identify about 90% of the population. And given the studies that we did, Ed, while you were actually at University of Wollongong with Dr. Abbas and a few years afterwards, because we were looking at emergency response at the time for avian, believe it or not, and other things like floods, fires, we noticed that the physical social network is very telling. And that is a whole different ballgame. That basically, people are creatures of habit. They get up, they drop off their kids if they have kids, and if they don't, they go straight to work, or they may go to the gym beforehand. They're at work all day. They might see clients, or they might travel to some client sites. Mainly, most people don't. They stay at the same location. And then they're doing the same thing, but in reverse. They pick up kids, and then they go home, and then they go to afternoon activities and go to sleep. I mean, this is the typical day of somebody. Mm. And you can know a lot about a community of interest by analyzing even anonymous data. I mean, we've got Australian Bureau of Statistics time of day data at 5-minute intervals. We've got collection district level data from the Australian Bureau of Census each 5 years. We've got data on the survey output, like how much do you spend on disposable, you know, what's your disposable income per household? Now, you might think these are fairly nebulous things, and I'm not saying our Australian government is going to do anything with this, but for me, the potential for how this might be used and retrospective use, we've seen it in every government application that's ever been rolled out. This is the main question. I actually believe this government. I actually believe that they will not abuse the data because they've made such a big song and dance, and there would be just absolute chaos on the streets, I believe, if they were to misuse or abuse the data retrospectively. And look at the laws that they've proposed. It's only a draft bill. But I do want to actually emphasize something. Not only the relative location tweaked back to the absolute location, but also the importance of the marrying up of the physical and virtual social networks, that's just priceless. Who you see every day is just priceless information. It's communities of interest. It's potentials for looking at illicit networks. It's potential to look at drug syndicates. It's potentials to look at crime syndicates, you know, burglaries, this whole huge space, which they're trying to do with big data anyway, in a predictive manner.
And Ed, when you do these technical write-ups, are you receiving a lot of Are you receiving responses from people saying, okay, I am comfortable with downloading the app thanks to the fact that at least I know the government's making strides from a technical standpoint, at least, to be as secure and as private as possible? Do you see that reaction?
I would say it's a very small reaction. So it's only just that fraction of people that were uncertain. I think the thing I'm observing is, you know, in this social discourse online, is there's already a lot of people that made up their mind long before, you know, anything qualifying if this was secure or not was made. You know, in one case, there's an existing distrust of politicians and how the Australian government has had a record on managing data. There's another person who I sense was doing it more for an anarchical reason, i.e. they didn't like Scott Morrison and they were quite open about that. And so I think it comes back to people will have, a lot of people will have an existing condition of I'll install this or not. And, you know, I'm guilty of that as well. I figured, hey, look, if I've got this downloaded, you know, ideally it should be informing policy to say, let's open up Australia again. And so that was kind of my informative decision. But then it was, okay, let's actually qualify what's happening here and try and be as objective as possible. And I think has probably been one of the interesting things I've noticed about the app is you'll have ardent techies who believe we can engineer our way out of anything. And you'll go all the way to the other extent where, you know, in one case, and I called it out in one of my posts, a particular individual made a very unqualified statement, and they were actually an academic themselves, and made an unqualified statement about the risk it poses to victims of domestic violence, which, you know, came back to, if this is what you're worrying about with a victim of domestic violence, you know, come on, we've got bigger problems to worry about. If that person's in a bad position, let's actually work on what that bad position is. And I think another piece of this is there's a lot of aspects that really just are, they're very much first world problems, if I can describe them that way.
Katina, when we have these discussions about the two camps with preset notions of government trust or trusting government or a lack of trust in government, how do you see that? And do you see, out of interest, a difference in geographical or in nations, particularly the two nations that you have your foot in, the United States and Australia?
Well, I do, definitely. In fact, often Australia and the US are used comparatively, and this is no difference in this instance, although I have to say we seem to have a greater trust at this very moment of our government than the Americans do of theirs. Preliminary polls have indicated that only about 50% of Americans even trust, and we've already had over a quarter of Australian adults download the app. You know, if we assume one download per adult, it's been very interesting. I think we still have what Eddie's saying, a polarized community of those perhaps who don't trust and those who do, and the middle clunk of pile of people who are perhaps apathetic, indifferent, and she'll be right, mate, kind of cultural mentality. And as we've already seen, just given a couple of days of the lifting of restrictions, is that people have almost gone back to normal. And I don't mean that that means that people are not taking precautions to stand further apart from one another in shops, but everyone's going out and about. And it's okay because our density is different, right? So when you look at markets and you look at urbanization, I just have to look at, you know, everyone saying, hail Australia and hail New Zealand for the wonderful inroads we've made into COVID. The answer is yes, we have, because we self-isolated sooner than most countries. But in actual fact, look at our population density. We've only got about 26 million people, right? America has 330 million plus people, almost 340 million. And so look at the crisis in New York, you know, look at the crisis in DC, look at the crisis in Los Angeles.
And what's the population of New York? It's about Australia. It's 20 million, exactly. Something like that. Yeah.
And you look at Wuhan similarly, but sort of different landscape. But yeah, density is a big thing when you're looking at telecommunications and when you're looking at interactions of people. How many per square meter, you know, or how many per square kilometer, or how many per what have you, whatever estimate we're looking at. And so the issues that we were talking about with Ed just a moment ago to do with pairing of devices and tethering, I mean, man, we can't even get our Bluetooth to work in the car sometimes. Sometimes it works and it's somebody else's conversation at home. You know, how many times does that happen to each other? And you're thinking, sweetheart, I heard the whole conversation. And you're going, that's okay, because, you know, we don't have anything to hide between one another. But, you know, it's like, but when you're wearing, I mean, the biggest one, and this has started to come out, like, lo and behold, I said this in 2017 at the Radio Communications Conference that the Australian Media Authority held. If you've got multiple implantables, like a cochlear, a heart pacemaker, and a diabetic pump, and by the way, there are people like that, you know, with two or more devices, you're going to get some noise. And electromagnetic frequencies have limitations. You know, I haven't looked at Australia's in Sydney. I know that some cities in the US last year came into a lot of issues with the capacity was reached. It was full. It's not unlimited. Yeah. Spectrum is not unlimited as we think. What is it like in the city of Sydney? And how do these, you know, if I'm wearing a Fitbit, an external wearable, I'm having the app in my phone, I've got earphones in my ears, and there's a printer that at home that I tether to, or I Bluetooth to, or in the office more precisely, this is when you get the non-reads galore. Like, this is when these things eat each other. There's a noise, right? Mm. So these are interesting scenarios that no one thought of. Someone complaining who's got a diabetic pump, hey, this iPhone app is stuffing with my pump.
Yeah,
we're going to hit these scenarios because it's on body, external and in-body. These are the three operational settings.
Yeah. And Katina, do you think also, and also Ed as well, but the fact that we are sort of humans sitting in a petri dish of a massive experiment on the enslaving of our attention from devices, which just so happen to act as perfect tracking devices by their own nature, regardless of any content tracing apps. Do you think there's a certain apathy or acceptance born of apathy that this app is just another thing that tracks us anyway because Google does the same thing and Apple does the same thing in different variants, and also all the apps that we download anyway, we don't read the privacy documents. I mean, I'm involved in security. I hardly read the privacy documents, although I do have a different OS installed on my phone. I mean, that's a major propagator of the mentality, right?
Yes. I mean, how many emails, how many LinkedIn posts, how many tweets did I see exactly that argument? Come on, you're worried about the government? Look at Google, right?
There you go.
This came over and over and over again. And then I started to look at the Fitbit experiments with Stanford University, right? Because they're looking at some amazing strategies for tracing that we haven't even thought of in Australia, right? Because we're looking at this because we just took the Singaporean model. Australia and Singapore always work together. They've got 20, 30 visions of things together, right? Because they see each other as very closely aligned and aspirations towards one another. But when you look at Fitbits, they record, and who owns Fitbit? Google does, 250,000 points of data, right? 250,000. You can find this on the Investor Stanford page with Fitbit because they're doing clinical trials in response to COVID, in a sort of COVID watch approach. So if we're thinking, oh my God, right, 250,000 points, blood oxygen levels, pulse rates, temperature, skin temperature, everything you can imagine, REM everything. States, blah, 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 then really, you know, the typical number of records, and I don't know what they are, I'd love to see a nice paper on the typical morphological number of interactions we have at 2 meters in each day. I'm sure it exists somewhere, but I'd love to see a nice clean paper that on average, you know, we interact with so many people per day. You know, they've done it for the internet. They've done it for the apps that we correlate with and we use. You know, how many apps do you use a day, or how many cookies do you leave behind? And if, well, let's do something that looks at what's the typical average interaction. And of course, it depends on the type of worker you are. It depends on your age. It depends on your culture and your demographic and geodemographic. But, you know, there are these parameters. But when you compare 250,000 Fitbit points a day to what contact tracing, you know, there's no comparison. But then I always say, as we did in the previous show, and Ed, maybe I'll pick your brains here. Who's behind? I haven't been able to find the name, a company name, apart from bluetrace.io, right? Who is the company that's supporting the government in deploying the services for contact tracing?
So that's been an enigma down here. I was seeing Ben Grubb, a journalist, and he was trying to hunt the contract that that was responsible for the application development. The development I know has occurred out of DTA. There's also another three or four development organisations as well. And in fact, I was speaking to another guy who's a client of mine who works in the dev space. He said, yeah, look, it was a case that I'll just get it done. And you know, I know if you also look at the code, Atlassian's involved as well. So there's about four or five different organisations involved in the Australian piece. I wouldn't say any of them really fall into places of disrepute, you know, companies that do active privacy tracing. I think, you know, looking at the firms involved so far, and I haven't fully qualified it, it's, you know, most of these are more DevOps houses. So, yeah, I don't think there's anyone out there that's doing, you know, active tracing or that's, you know, doing, you know, that's selling deliberately any sort of privacy invasive technology here. But I think that's actually a good point, is who's behind it and, you know, what are their intentions? And, you know, I think for the most part, it's all quite positive. And you know, the ones and zeros reflect that. I think just back to Nick's point on privacy. So I have it in the first discussion paper I introduce and inject into my classes that looks at Google when they did their Wi-Fi wall drive and were able to pick out people's houses and capture data and have on record data that they shouldn't have, which was brought up in Germany. The Germans have very good cause for being very specific about what data you can record on human beings, given you know how the 1932 or 33 census, I believe it was, how that was employed later by Nazi Germany. And so that's kind of informed their record. But I also like passing this off to students who come from India or China. When we go through that discussion paper, I sort of inject the cultural aspect of, okay, well, what are your thoughts on privacy? And for a lot of people, it's a very non-existent concept. So I think this is going to be another curiosity is, you know, as these technologies evolve, will privacy actually be a driving focus, or is this just a Western concept that's been informed by, you know, by the Napoleonic period as well as World War II and other historical examples where information has been used against us?
Yeah, I think that's a great point because, there are a couple of things. One reminds me of I was asked to do a lecture many years ago at Sydney University on some things as a guest. And I was talking about why potentially people in impoverished nations who had access to the internet may not have too many moral qualms in using that internet to develop malware and steal cash, right? And what I noticed was a lot of the Bangladeshis in the audience and a lot of the, predominantly the Bangladeshis in a country where I've lived before, were not in their heads. And even if they would have been the richer Bangladeshis who were able to afford to go to Sydney Uni for a first year cybersecurity course, I asked the question at the end of the discussion. I said, so what are your thoughts on that? Do you understand why? And some of the shaking heads were, I asked, and I said, so, and you know, do you understand or can you empathize with that situation? And they were shaking heads and Bangladeshis nodding heads. And I think there's a very real, you know, understanding of your environment. We could draw a parallel to the events and the containment. Yes, from a cultural perspective, but also from experiential perspective. In Singapore and Taiwan, although Singapore slightly opened up a bit, but from the SARS and MERS outbreaks historically, and compare that with, say, Italy. Now, Italy never experienced a SARS or a MERS outbreak, so they didn't know what was coming for them. And now that we have been hit massively and horribly, next time we will certainly be prepared. So again, you know, we had to get this. We unfortunately, very unfortunately, we had to go through this hurdle, go through this period in order to inform our actions next time, the same as your reference to Nazi Germany. And now look at, you know, one of the meccas in privacy rights and advocacy, it's Berlin, you know, the heart. So yeah, interesting.
It is interesting. I'm going to say something really quick there, Nick, that Avian in 2006, when it came back, a little resurgence from its initial outbreak in 1997, they were trying a lot of very different things, but you got to think about the time. Why weren't these applications or services attempted earlier? Well, they were. We had, you know, the SARS mobile alert system in Hong Kong, which Sunday Telecom developed within 48 hours on a weekend and deployed, which was you could SMS a number and it would tell you whether you're within 1 kilometer of a SARS-infected building. And so we see these kinds of things, but we have to remember in 2006, there were only 12 million Facebook users. Twitter had just launched in March of 2006. The cloud was really not the cloud. It was like managed services, right? We've had this collision. You know, we've got a digital transformation agency now, DTA. We have had this change, and this has been the first litmus test for the whole world, you know, in terms of emergency. And we've discussed proportionality last week, market-specific items, but is this the first litmus test? And, okay, we failed, and I'm going to call it preliminary. I don't think we're going to get 40% in Australia. We might get 35, we might get 30, we might not. But what I'm going to say is that really quickly is that this was the first test. We're going to go back to the drawing board and go, now, what did we learn from that experience? This is not over. The COVID safe is not a vaccine, and we may not have a vaccine for another 12 months. But what do we do with the learnings? Do we give more consultation next time?
Yeah. Ed, this is a technical focus as well, but I'm going to take it away from the content tracing app now because we're basically wrapping up. I wanted to comment on one of the activities that you're working on, which is, I guess, one of the, you know, the many positive outcomes of international collaboration that has come off the back of this shared experience that we, most people in the world are going through, and that's the CTI League. Now, I was talking about the CTI League actually with an initiative which has just been established in Geneva called the Cyber Peace Institute. And what Cyber Peace Institute aims to do is act as an emergency response team to assist emergency response teams in vulnerable countries or in vulnerable populations. Very good initiative, lots of top minds working with it, and they reference CTI League, and fantastic initiative. And I see that you've been volunteering with them. So can you give us a bit of a sense of what that's about and how that that ties into, well, I guess the podcast broad theme, which is cybersecurity?
Yeah. So I tagged into this group about towards the end of March. It was organised by Mark Rogers, a couple of guys from Microsoft, and who was the other chap? Another gentleman based
Cyberism, out in
New York, who's Israeli originally, but Mark sort of just sent an email out and said, "Hey, if anyone wants to tag in, build up some skills, and contribute some of your own, please do." So, jumped into that. Funnily enough, there weren't any other Australians on board at that time, so I had a few contacts down in Canberra who were able to, you know, I started passing off a lot of the information and coordinating through ACSC. The identification of, I think we saw 87 hosts that were associated with critical, with healthcare or similar infrastructure that could have been readily attacked. So we started mapping those out, started coordinating through ACSC a bit of incident response. There's also been a few.
And just for the listeners in Europe, ACSC?
Oh, yep, sorry. ACSC is the Australian Cybersecurity Centre. So we have our spy agency, the ASD, that are very similar to NSA. They have a civilian group that's quite separate from them that that deals with cybersecurity risks as they occur in Australia, just because our spy agency doesn't get used domestically and it's very specific. So ACSC was spun up more so on cybersecurity matters. So a few of my students were also there. So we've just been working with them and coordinating incident response, just because if they're getting a phone call from Ed from the internet, it doesn't look too good. So having ACSC starting to drive a lot of that has been phenomenal, alongside just half a dozen other areas I've been diving into with the group. So it's good to contribute, but I've also been introduced to a whole heap of new tools and techniques that I hadn't seen before. And you know, that's going to equip us quite well moving into the future. And yeah, it's been fun. Yeah. It's also cut away a lot of bureaucracy as well. And there's a massive collaboration that's taking place. And that's, you know, that's been awesome to see.
Yeah. And it's, it, There are numerous examples of scientific collaboration as well, you know, notwithstanding some of the attempts at blocking from, you know, different nations. There's plenty of silver linings in international collaboration in this. So I think perhaps we can sign off. Either of you have any other comments until the next installation, which I'm sure there will be, because there's plenty more to discuss.
This is endless. I just wanted to say, what a buzz for me, Nick Kelly, to bring me on with Ed, a former student. Wollongong's pretty awesome, don't you think? But I love where you've gone, Ed, and I love what you said about Dr. M.G. Michael, who said something and inspired you, particularly on the path of security. I'm very grateful for that news.
Oh, it's good. It's, you know, I'm glad to be sitting here with you as well and, you know, hopefully motivating and inspiring a few more people.
Fantastic. Well, and I hope to be hosting inspirational people like both of you as well in the future. So thank you very much both for coming on. And yes, until the next time, stay safe, stay well.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you.
Cheers.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.